Hello again, and welcome to another episode of Veterans of the Long War, miniature wargaming podcast. That rolls off the tongue.
Yeah,
I got Joe here again, as usual.
Ahoy, friends.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. We are back, old school style, just me and Joe this time, catching up with you a little more frequently than our last episode or two. So,
Yeah, doing our best to get back toward the meat of the month, you know, somewhere toward the middle to the beginning, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so it hasn't been too long since our last conversation. So, you know, not a whole ton has changed on the gaming front, but actually, in a way, a few things have changed. So it's kind of it's interesting.
So anyway, we are Veterans of the Long War. You can always find us on Facebook. We have a good page there with lots of photos and article posts and shares, comments. So connect with us there. This is episode 41. We're finally into the 40s.
Woo-hoo.
And just plugging away, being strong, trying to do a fun podcast about miniature wargaming, about Warhammer 40K, about whatever else fancies our conversations.
Yeah, nerd stuff.
Yep. So that's what we're going to do again this week or this month. Usually start off with games played and hobby progress. I have been recovering from being sick for like pretty much 2 weeks. So last night, club night, was one of the first nights I actually went out and wasn't home resting. So haven't done a whole lot. Played one game of Kings of War last night at the Sector. Always fun to go to club night.
Yeah, good times.
And had been done last episode. Arlen was making fun of me for the sweatshop like conditions of my my painting schedule. didn't do that much painting this podcast, but managed to sit down over the weekend when I was finally feeling a little bit better and got vertical, and I painted some of those D&D, I think we'll talk about this at the end maybe, but some of the new D&D and Pathfinder minis. I got some ghouls for my Kings of War army for them. And
yeah, that stuff's coming along nice. I know you posted a few pictures of your Kings of War progress over the last, I don't know, month or so. And it's
last month.
Lots of work.
That was the big Kings of War. The whole army got placed on the table and movement trays got painted and everything got kind of TLC'd up. So continuing to plug away with that. Did some ghouls for my undead. Still trying to figure out how I want to run my undead army. And picked up some a few more things, a few more Reaper bones, skeletons with spears, a few of those D&D zombie minis. So I'm going to have some zombies. And I picked up a Reaper bones. I think it's called the Hellcat. It's like a flaming four-legged beast that I'm going to use as a hellhound.
Yeah, those ones you were using last night?
No, this is a different one. This is the Reaper bones. It's the white plastic stuff.
Oh, sure, sure.
It looks kind of like, I don't know, it looks like a lionish thing. It's got like rocky skin. I think I'm going to paint it to match the other warg and hellhounds.
Cool.
That I have a unit of. But yeah, that one, the clear ones, those are also the from that D&D minis line, those clear hellhounds, which are weird because it's like I kind of don't know what to do with them because they look cool clear.
Yeah, they do.
I don't really know how to put paint on them and leave parts of it clear. So anyway, that'll probably be a something shiny topic when we'll talk about this nice line of minis that has come out. The only other thing I think I did hobby wise was I dummied up a 40K Tyranid Mucolid Spore. Again, with 8th edition coming out, I have no idea if that will still be an option to sort of ally in a flyerant with a cheap troops choice like a Mucolid Spore, but if it should still be a playable option, that was my intent.
Sure, yeah, fill up that out. Ally.
And then this little Mucolid Spore was again another one of these Reaper Bones plastic minis. I forget what it was called. It's like a shamble. I don't know, some kind of shambling mound or spore pod or something. But it's just like this puffy thing with gelatinous tentacles, and I drilled into it. I drilled into the bottom of it and put it on a clear 40K, you know, like a gun drone, you know, something you put a screamer on, you know, the clear, the post.
Yeah, yeah.
To make it look like it's floating, and I just dummied up a little base for it. So if mucolid spores are still possible to be fielded, you know, a single spore, then I've got that going for me, which is nice. It was my birthday recently, and I haven't received it yet, but one of my birthday presents was a not a fat mat, but you know, another off-brand gaming mat. So I'm really looking forward to that coming in. It's a grassy plain style, so it'll be nice. Really Kings of War. It'll be good for 40K, whatever. I'm even thinking I could like lay my swamp, my 3x3 swamp on top of it to get like two textures going.
Yeah, you probably could. Yeah.
So I'm looking for, hopefully that, I won't say what the company is because I don't know what it is offhand and I haven't received the product yet. So hopefully it'll be a nice product and worth the weight and effort. But that is in the mail. I did pick up the Shadow War Armageddon book that came out recently for 40K. That's a nice little book. I'm not super into Shadow War right now because, like, you know, 8th edition is weeks away, but
right.
It is nice to have, you know.
It's a fun game. I managed to get a few games in this next month I'll talk about in a few minutes, but it's a lot of fun once you your demo night was not the best presentation.
I totally get that, but you know, it's not so much that, it's just the opportunity to have another way to play with 40K models,
absolutely.
All self-contained in one book. You know, even if I'm not super interested in it right now, like that was too, you know, I knew it was a good opportunity.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely. That's something you could pick up years from now.
And still.
Yeah, exactly. Kind
of little self-contained little thing that I could always have. So, and GW continues to make great books. You know, it looks great. It's got, you know, it's quality.
Yeah, the production value is good. Yeah.
And I think that's it. I think I did a little hobby. I played one. We played a game at Kings of War. You want to talk about that?
We can talk about that.
Yeah, it was fun. It was a good game. You brought a very, very shooty Dark Elves with a little bit of Abyssal.
Super shooty.
Also shooty Abyss. And I brought my sort of build that I've been tweaking a little bit here and there is the just super fast and all assault abyss, you know, demons basically.
Right.
For those that don't know Kings of War, the demon models pretty much transfer over to Forces of the Abyss pretty perfectly.
It was a good game. I mean, it's the classic, like, you know, army that has to charge versus the army that's going to kind of stand there and shoot.
Yep.
And my list's a little deceiving because it looks like straight gun line, but I actually I have some decent mobility on my flanks with some with some units, and I basically just kind of annoyed you on the flanks and kept units busy, and then I was kind of able to isolate your center with a lot of my shooting. And I mean, it's one of those where, like, that tactic will probably work the first time we play against each other, but if, you know, the next time we rack up, your whole approach is going to be different, and therefore I have to change mine. And that's, I think, a lot of what's so fun about Kings of War in our group right now is, like, there's not enough time for any of us to, like, lay dominance on each other. We're all still kind of exploring, and even just, like, you take the same list and play two or three times, and your tactics are going to change, and you're going to adapt.
Yeah, it definitely made me think, like, I have some really fast stuff on the flanks, and my, you know, I just sort of was like, okay, that's my gimmick. Move fast, get as close to you as possible, as fast as possible. But now I'm realizing, like, once I'm with, you know, if I have an 18-inch charge range, it doesn't matter if I'm 17 inches away from you or, you know, 6 inches away from you. So, I gotta be more conscious of my flanks, you know, my sides.
Right. And I was able to kind of, and this is a lot of basically my Warhammer Fantasy experience coming in, where you don't have that background, but you're going to pick it up quick. You're a good gamer. where the line of sight arcs, and I was kind of able to play a little bit.
Yeah.
I had gargoyle units and heralds of woe, which are kind of like the old dark elf dark riders. They're basically like a skirmishy shooty unit that moves really fast, and they kind of just harass Bob on the sides by basically just getting out of his line of sight arc on each unit, and they didn't even deal that much damage. They were just kind of in annoying places and hard to get at, and it took you a lot of resources to deal with them.
Yeah, my build, you know, I got a lot of elite. You had a lot of MSU, so you were able to out-deploy me, and it was just a lot of cheap units versus significantly less expensive units. So it was a good, really good game. Learned a lot, and we probably could have done one more turn if I had remembered those units had Fury at the end.
Sure, because
it was like three things that wavered, and I was like, oh, well, then this is over. But really, I could have countercharged with all three of those things or two of those things. I forget exactly how it went. But you would have peppered away with me. It would have been one more turn. But, you know, I would have gotten to kill. That's what's cool about the game is, like, I was killing stuff throughout the game. You know, I wasn't ever really, like, super, like, close to winning the game. Like, you were controlling the game most of the time. But I was killing stuff. I was getting things off. So...
it's definitely we're like, in contrast to current 40K, where like if someone kind of has control of the table, they can almost make it so you can't hurt them at all.
Right. I did like one wound, like, you know, one hull point to that one vehicle.
Right, and now I'm gonna roll my 2+3 rollable. Yeah. it's got a lot of.
But that doesn't happen in Kings of War. It's much more. Even if it's like super tuned up army versus not so, you know, the not so is going to lose, but it's not going to be an unfun blowout. You know.
Right. You're gonna be able to remove some models. And we talked about this a bit last night and kind of are so far. I mean, I've done it a couple more times, but you're kind of figuring it out, is the multi-basing. It's such an attractive aspect of Kings of War, like deploying and putting our armies away was such a cinch. Yeah. And I know that your whole army wasn't, neither was mine, but a majority of my units, I basically have glued them to the unit trays until I get around to painting them. And it's just so easy to pick up. It's almost like you're deploying 8 or 9 models. Exactly. Rather than, you know, a block of 40 models, it's one piece. It's one game piece.
And if the game goes sideways and by turn one, you can be like, you know what, let's re-rack. And you just pick up your 12 pieces and you put it back. And, you know, like, it's just a different different vibe, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
I definitely feel more... like, I have more energy for a second game of Kings of War, much so more so than any other, like, large scale.
Yeah, and that game was pretty quick. I mean, I know, Arlen and I went outside a couple times to hang out and stuff, but, like, even counting all that, it was quick. It was, like, 2 hours.
It was still, like, a 2.5-hour game.
Yeah.
But we probably played, like, 4 turns. We could have played 5.
Right.
That 5th turn, we could have played that out in, like, 10 minutes.
Sure.
So.
Yeah. Just a super fun game, and definitely was... I haven't played Kings of War in a long time. I know you and Arlen got to play, like, last month or something.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so... Yeah, like, I'm every time I play, I get the itch again. Like, I just want to play that game more, where there's other games that I've played in the past and even currently where, like, you play and you have that sour experience and you're almost like... there's something else I could be doing. Where with Kings of War, it's like, even if it goes bad, like you said, you're just sort of like, all right, well, I'm excited to try the next game and see how I can do better. So, yeah, that's a sign of a good game, and honestly, a lot of those aspects seem to be traveling to 40K, but that's a topic for later.
Right. So I think that's me.
Cool. All right, so I'll jump in. When I first sat down tonight and I was kind of taking notes on, like, what was my hobby progress, I haven't actually been able to do a ton of stuff as far as, like, putting paint on models. Surprise, surprise. I did finish painting up my Dark Age Goliath. I showed you that model last night. I posted a couple pictures on my Facebook a while ago. It's a really cool model. He's got, like, spikes coming out of him. There's skulls on his shoulders. And I kind of did this dark gray with a purple hue. And he's got, like, a purple loincloth with some armor plates. I'm really happy with the way he came out. I really liked the model. He was one of those things where, like, as soon as I got the model, I had to just open it, put it together, and paint it. Like, I couldn't wait. I put everything else on hold, and I worked on this model. And I did have a few issues with that. I was kind of explaining to you last night, and I'll kind of go over it here. It it was a resin model, and I've worked with plenty of resin models before. I've purchased a variety of different kinds of models, and oftentimes with resin, when you have issues with paint sticking to resin, you're supposed to wash it. You're supposed to take like a dish soap because there's a releasing agent they use that fills in the porous material, and sometimes that rejects the paint. So I did that. I scrubbed it down with a soft toothbrush. I really gave it a good scrub. But for some reason, the arm on the Goliath, every time I put paint on it, it would dry completely. I'd come back and I'd wipe it very lightly, and the paint would just peel right off. So I had almost resolved to just basically taking my razor knife and scratching up the whole model. Even though I knew it wouldn't look great, at least I'd get some paint on there. But I did some searching on the internet and found some forum somewhere where some guy had done this before, or I should say some person had done this before. And they recommended using white glue, like Elmer's glue or tacky glue, and mixing that with your base coat and basically using that extra adhesion to get the paint to stick. And then once it dries to tack, then paint over it, because if you let it dry too hard, it'll get that sort of Elmer's glue kind of foggy, plasticky kind of seal on there. And surprisingly, that worked perfect. So, I mean, I don't want to say, you know, it's expert advice or anything, but it worked for me. And if anyone else out there has issues with paint sticking to models, we were talking about painting those Bones models before, and when you paint them, they get kind of tacky.
Those are weird. You're not supposed to prime those.
Like, yeah.
You're just supposed to use acrylics. Most spray paints, Rattle Can, like if you base prime with Rattle Can spray paint, like it makes the bones really sticky and really gross. But
yeah,
once you get
an to work with.
Once you get a full layer of acrylic on them, they're fine.
Right. So I'm wondering if you could use that same method to undercoat the bones if you were to hand undercoat them. But regardless, if anyone has adhesion issues on their paint, I recommend just try a little dot of Elmer's glue, mix it in, and see if that helps. That's really the only models I completely painted. I did some more work on the three. I have three Warp Spider X-Arcs, which complete my collection of all Warp Spiders, and I just can't seem to motivate myself to get past about 50% on them. They're just about block painted. I need to, you know, wash and then highlight, and then they'll be done. But I can't seem to motivate myself toward it, so they're sitting on my painting table kind of just staring at me, but they're there. A lot of my Kings of War stuff was my old Dark Elf army, and so lots of it is in like bits and pieces. And so even like last night I had some chariot bases, which were the right size bases, but I kind of just had like the bits of the model on there. I didn't really have full models. Well, I was able to assemble one complete base of Dark Elf chariots, which was nice. And so that sort of fit the template on how I'm going to position them in the base, and really gave me that look as far as, you know, is this going to work, or am I going to need to fit like three chariots on here, or two chariots going to look full enough? Because I want to use the multi-basing rules to, you know, use as much of my collection to build as many units as I can, but I also don't want it to look chintzy. You know, if I'm going to put all this work in, I want it to look decent. And so I really liked the way it came out, and it inspired me to kind of look online as far as what's out there for alternate companies' chariots, scale chariots, 28mm chariot. And I found a company that does some laser-cut MDF board, and they're actually Celtic Chariots laser-cut MDF. So they look pretty cool. There were two chariots to like a $10 little package. So I bought one. I haven't put them together yet, but if they work out as well as I hope they're going to, I may get a couple more and build some more regiments of chariots, because I really kind of like the way they look in the pictures, but I haven't, like I said, have put the time into to build them and mount them on a base yet to see how they're going to look. But I'm going to kind of, you know, Dark Elf bits them up so they don't just look like Celtic chariots. But if they can serve the role of sort of that husk of the chariot, the wheels, the chariot itself, and then mm-hmm. the part that connects to the horse, then that's perfect, because I have the cold ones I need, I have the Dark Elf models I need, and I can bits them up real good, and I think they'll look pretty sharp. So I'm excited to get those together. And then I have two kind of cool purchases that we do count as hobby progress here on Veterans of the Long War. The first one is just the Warhammer Quest card game. I haven't opened it yet, but FFG and GW, their license is ending or has ended, and so it's a game that's not going to be around forever. So I was able to get it pretty inexpensively on Amazon, and so I have it. I'm itching to play it. It seems cool. The reviews are neat. But I sort of got it because, you know, it's one of those, it's not going to be around forever, and I got a super good deal on it. And it is something that I think if I learned the system, I could probably put a game together with my friends, three or four of my friends, in probably, you know, maybe an hour or so. So that's kind of fun. And then the last kind of cool purchase I got was there's a book that they sell. As far as I know, they only sell it at the Warhammer main store in England, and it's the Eldar sketchbook, and it's all the hand sketches that Jess Goodwin has ever done for the Eldar, the Craftworld Eldar, and I was able to get my hands on a copy thanks to some people in the Eldar Facebook group that actually are in England, and this guy was able to purchase some at the store and then just basically added shipping and gave me cover price on whatever he got the book for. So I was able to pick one up, and it's been super cool. It's sort of like the ultimate bathroom reader. You know, you can kind of just sit there and just look, and it's really neat. Some of the drawings are from like 1989. You know, they're super old stuff.
Yeah, you showed it to me. The old school stuff is really intriguing. Yeah, all the sketch work, and
it's cool to see like the concept pictures moving into like the more detailed technical drawing, and then you get into like the Wraith Knight, where he actually hand sketched out all the parts of the arm that he thought the model needed to be cast in and things like that. So it's just really cool purchase. I guess he'd have to be an Eldar fanboy to really care about it, but I got it for a decent price. It was like $40, and it was worth getting for me. It's you know, I've been Eldar player for 20 something years, so it was just sort of my fanboy purchase. So that's pretty much my hobby progress. The next month I'll probably not get very much done. I have a lot of traveling to do. I'm on vacation next week, and then in a couple weeks I have to travel overseas for work, so I won't be able to do much work. I'm hoping I can bring some stuff to do some painting while I am abroad, so that you know, I'll have some downtime, and I need something that's out of, you know, bring me back home a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping I'm able to kind of stash some paints and maybe a couple models in my check-in bag and
do it, man. I've done it,
and just get some work done while I'm out there. I think it'd be kind of nice. So games
painting
played
in hotel rooms, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've done it before, but it's,
I did it once.
Usually for like, I was painting for the next day's tournament. Like, So games played. We talked about my only Kings of War game, and I did play one game of 40K since our last podcast, and it was against Dylan. It was on Indie Cartage Fest. There was a giant team game of 40K that was going on. It was 2v2. They played 4,000 points per side, so 2,000 per player, and that was a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, how come you didn't get in on that?
Well, I sort of started getting in on it, and then there was a lot of people who said they were going to be showing up who didn't, so I wanted to make sure someone was there to play other games. And so we had an odd number, so I said, all right, well, I'll spend some more time with my son in the morning. I'll show up a little later, and I'll be there if someone wants to play Shadow War or Dark Age or something else, or even 40K. And luckily for me, Dylan was coming by, so he stopped around 5 o'clock, and we got a 1250 game of 40K in.
But the team game was Orcs and Demons versus Space Wolves and what else?
And let's see, Space Wolves and Imperial Guard. So Corwin ran his Assault Imperial Guard. It was all Bulgrins and layers
Strachan,
of characters. And And then the Space Wolves was Neftali, and he had a couple units of Wolfen, a couple units of Thunder Wolves, and some Grey Hunters, kind of backing it all up. And then Luke had his typical flying monstrous creature funness. And Adam was running Orcs.
Orcs and a lot of trucks.
A couple of battle wagons. And the Demons and Orcs kind of played it cagey because the other side was very assaulty. So they kind of sat back and let the summoning do the summoning. And it was kind of funny because the very first turn in the very first psychic phase, the blue scribes sacrificed themselves to become a bloodthirster. So they were first blood. And after 7.5 hours of gameplay, the game came down to a tie. So that one decision to not use Fate Weaver to reroll that had a play in the final score of the game. But of course, the Bloodthirster in 7.5 hours of gameplay took place that. But it's just fun to talk about.
That's funny.
So the other game the other game that took place on that day was the game of 40K that I played with Dylan. It was a 1250 game. I used my Craftworld Eldar, and he used the Ultramarines. I think it's like the Strike Force Ultra. It's that big box set he won as a door prize at a tournament. and it comes with like a Land Raider, a Razorback, a drop pod.
It's like the box is a formation or something?
Yeah, exactly. And it's about like 1,000 to 1,250 points.
That's cool.
Yeah, so he ran that, and he's got a decent amount of it painted now. He's kind of trying to really convert himself into an Ultramarines player. He ran that formation. It's got kind of a well-rounded formation, and I ran a very it was an Aspect host, and it was very like Warp Spider based. I had the Scathach Wraith Knight. I had four units of Warp Spiders. I had a unit of Dire Avengers, some Fire Dragons. It was a fairly well-balanced list on both our sides, and basically it was a super close game. And after about, I think it was maybe 2.5 or 3 hour game, because we were, you know, taking our time enjoying ourselves, and that also ended in a tie. So, two 40 gig games ending in ties, which was kind of interesting. So, it was a lot of fun. I love playing 40k. There was some aggravation, you know, just the additions getting old, and I'm starting to get bothered by some of these things, rollable saves and things like that. But
we
both had our fair share of cheese, so it's not like it was anything against Dylan or the Ultramarines.
That's just what
it's
just
the nature of 40K right now, and so
Well, you guys have sort of coalesced. Like the only 40K being played right now is like you and Lucas and Dylan, who are bringing like your crazy tournament builds.
It's
like
true.
Last night there was Gulliman and Drop Pods versus like
Fate Weaver
and summoning demons.
Yep.
I mean, it's like all the like super high level like epic craziness is it works when
everybody
both
is playing that.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
So that's sort of the only 40K that's being played is that kind of epic style.
Yeah, it's true.
Whoa, like,
it's true,
what
and that's kind
doing?
Of that's the state of the game right now, basically. I mean, if you're people who play are either playing very narratively or they're playing the type of games that we're playing, which is just sort of super high powered. They're over either super quick or they're these long drawn out, you know, slugfests of cheese after cheese. And it's fun to some degree when you know that that's what you're going in, you know, for, and that's mm-hmm. what you've chosen to play. So we enjoy it. We're definitely all looking forward to 8th edition. Okay, there's so much to talk about that I'm almost like you know, stuck as to what to talk about. So I think what I would like to discuss first of all is just sort of these faction focus articles that they've come out with,
mm-hmm.
and I might not
yeah,
be able
I've been
to
trying
list them
to
all,
keep
but
up.
There's Eldar, Dark Eldar, Astra Militarum, Tau, Demons.
I've done a bunch. Yeah,
there's a whole slew of them, and I may have missed some there too. Really cool. I like that the articles are written sort of by Reese, by Frankie, you know, mm-hmm. maybe by committee, but at least those are the figureheads of the articles that they're doing.
Right, and it's usually like they're like Frankie wrote about Dark Eldar, like, because he's passionate about that. You know, like, they're picking the armies that they're passionate about to write about. So it's definitely from the heart, and those guys mean well.
They were part of the crew that got to playtest them, so I'd sort of like to think that they're the ones that have, like you're saying, that warm place in their heart for this faction, so they want to make sure this faction works in the new edition kind of thing. But I like the faction focused articles a lot because they give sort of a few drops of statistics or crunch or, you know, whatever, but a lot of it is just sort of like the Eldar one I'll talk about specifically. He calls out the fact that, you know, every competitive army is bikes, warp spiders, and wraith knights. Like,
and I like when they do that.
You know, and then they're like, what if your army could be built of striking scorpions and phoenix lords and these things that are literally, they're talking to me. You know, the models that I have on my mm-hmm. shelf that I haven't touched in years, you know, those kind of things. And that excites me in a very almost Kings of War kind of way, where it's like, I'm so excited to run kind of whatever I want, and it seems like it'll sort of work. I mean, obviously there's going to be synergies that work best and use this with that unit and all that stuff, but I like the idea that it's a faction's not going to be shoehorned into taking three or four of their most elite units and that's it, or at least theoretically that's how they're presenting it, and I think that's super exciting. You know, every single faction-focused document or article that comes out, obviously it's about one specific faction, but it sort of isolates and details to some degree what the special function of that army is going to be able to do. Like they discussed an Astra Militarum, they talked about the Lehman Russ stat line and how it's, I think it was like toughness 8 with 12 wounds or something along those lines. It's a really durable, vehicle, and we learned a little more that obviously vehicles don't seem like they're going to have sides anymore and things like that. And then we learned about orders and how they automatically are going to work now and that they still exist. There's still a function for orders, which makes me think there's still going to be, doctrines for the Marines. There's still going to be, the special assault rules for the Gene Stealer cult. You know, every faction is still going to have their thing.
Today, I think today or yesterday, the article on reserves came out, and they specifically mentioned, Gene Stealer cult will get their little thing. They didn't say what, but, they're going to – hopefully they will make it so that you just always want to, like, both reach into your closet for, like, old models you never used to use and also make it so that every single model – in their line is like a model that you might want to purchase. Like, instead of making it like Eldar came out and now everyone needs bikes and warp spiders, make it so Eldar came out and this guy wants scorpions and that guy wants banshees and that guy wants wave serpents. And like, make it so that everybody can try out different things and play with all the toys,
But exactly.
That is a really tall order, so I'm willing to, give a lot of leeway when this edition comes out. As long as we see something in that direction,
right? Yeah, there's no way everything's going to be perfect, but they have the opportunity and they're laying the foundation to be able to address it in the future. Mm-hmm. They've even called it out a few times in these articles and the other more rules based articles is just sort of almost them saying, don't worry, if we don't get it right, we'll fix it.
I love that they're planning on trying to balance it yearly. I think the model has been shown a couple different places, so I think they can do it, rebalance the game yearly, which I love. I love that idea.
So, speaking of new ideas to GW, how do you feel about the new Primarch Marines? How do you feel about the new faction, maybe? The new Marine model unit?
I don't know exactly what the plan is with those. I haven't been super paying attention to them. Marines are, a very peripheral, as far as my likes and what I like to play in 40K. But, of course, I own Marines, so I'm, kind of aware of it, but I don't even really know what they are. These are like the guys that came back with Guliman and they're like buffed up or somehow.
Yeah, they're his special brew. He's had these Marines, Yeah, and I'm not sure if is this supposed to, fracture the I know there's now the sort of that Dark Imperium. There was an article about that, and I gotta admit, I'm not super up to snuff on Imperial, narrative, so. Mm-hmm. But, is this a sort of pseudo... Is this going to be a faction of Marines that doesn't worship the Emperor? Or maybe, looks down upon normal Marines? Or is this a business ploy so that in 5 years, all Marines are going
to
be these bigger models?
Over. I don't know.
So
I don't know. There definitely has to be, because they're not doing... If the things go the way they go, they're not going to have the same... money-making opportunity. It's not going to be people aren't going to be consuming codexes like they used to if the new edition plays out the way it looks like. And hopefully it's not going to be these splashes where boom, this book comes out and now you all are rushing out to buy X. And then boom, this book comes out and now you are, instead of, I don't think they're going to be able to create those land grab opportunities anymore. I think it's going to have to be more more general. They're going to have to rely on, like,
it's going to be, like, I would guess a more model-based, you know, I mean, you can come out with a model and splash it out and then correct the rules in the next yearly update. So, I mean, they still have the ability to do that, but it just feels like their focus now is on, we are still Games Workshop. We're not just, you know, Models Workshop. Mm-hmm. You know, it feels like they're embracing that whole game aspect again, and that's important. And kind of back to one of the points that we were making earlier in the conversation is with these faction-focused documents, having the people who literally took part in some of the playtesting, and you know, I'm not saying Reese and Frankie were down there creating the stat lines for the models, but they were certainly influencing or being part of the conversation of the influencing of this next edition. And it's nice to hear from them, you know, we hope we got it right. You know what I mean? Our effort was there rather than, you know, yeah, we've been playing it out and it looks like this is going to be the next hotness, because these are guys that were like that, you know, in their history, because they're tournament players and they're tournament oriented. And so they were part of the crew that would digest new rules as they come out and kind of let you know what the new hotness was going to be and let you know, and right. So it's neat to hear from them, the player that is still, you know, geared that way to say, hey, you know what? All these things are options and everything seems like it's going to work great. And yeah, it's all part of the sales pitch and ploy, but I feel like I can buy it more because I've sort of watched Reese and Frankie progress over the last, you know, 10 years and seen their business grow from a painting studio to some battle reports online to now, you know, influencing the next generation of our game. It's cool to see, and you sort of feel like, you know, if they're helping, there's no reason I couldn't be helping. You know what I mean? It feels very grassrootsy and home. Homegrown kind of thing, and I think that helps me kind of buy into this next edition as well, because it just feels like they're using the players to help design a game.
Yeah, it has to players, be a first. You know, they actually reached out to like the competitive people and said, "Give us input." You know more than I, but it really seems like all prior editions were sort of play tested in a pretty small vacuum. You know, where they weren't thinking like. They weren't thinking, how can we break the game, you know? They were thinking, how can we just have fun with this?
Yeah, how do we create these cool stories and cool scenarios? Yeah, and it's just it's a whole different focus. And I think it's smart of them to finally acknowledge that, you know,
most people
you can't ignore that competitive gamer.
That's where their money comes from. It's the competitive player that is constantly involved. They're constantly buying, switching to the newer, better army, picking up the other armies' books just to know their rules. Like, the competitive players are the ones that spend the money consistently, no matter, like, they don't walk away from the game, you know, they're just there. So I think that there is, you know, there is an economic reason to respect the competitive side of the game.
Absolutely.
Seems like it took a really long time to get there.
Yeah, it does. I think there's another podcast I listen to. I forget what it's called. I'll try and look it up as I talk about it. But basically, they're going over their last few episodes have been going over sort of the history of 40K, and it's always kind of interesting when other people go over it, because it's always going to come from a certain perspective. I mean, there's been no factual timeline that's been kept of Games Workshop. It's going to be this opinionated article, this person's opinion, this person's the Battle Hosts is the name of the podcast, and they went through recently and they talked about sort of when GW first embraced the internet and they first put themselves out there, and they got such the negative feedback that they immediately just sort of retracted and ignored the internet. They were just sort of like, this doesn't exist and it'll go away. And the internet didn't go away.
The internet became
like the most powerful entity on the planet.
It became,
you know,
the greatest purveyor of cheese. Like, you know, the cheese was able to spread so quickly.
Exactly.
You know, you didn't have to wait till like that guy from the other game shop showed up and was like, oh, you didn't notice this? Like, it's, you know, you combo this and it's like, oh, you know, like now you just go online and like you just type in like whatever tournament list you want. And you're like, oh, that's how I'd be. So That is...
But with that change, I mean, the internet's probably a whole... We could probably have a podcast topic just about how the internet's influenced our geek culture and games. But the point is, the internet grew, and Games Workshop, it seems like they just kept this hard-nosed, you know, nope, we're just going to give you what... You know, that old business philosophy of... We'll tell you what you want. We'll tell you what you need. And we live in a culture now where we can access every company we buy something from. We can go to, you know, there's fast food chains that have arguments on Twitter now. Like, we can go right to the source and say, hey, listen, this is what we want. And it's just smart business sense for them to say, hey, we're not number one dog around here. We got to make some changes. And you and I were saying this a few years ago when they stopped being number one, and games like Attack Wing and War Machine and stuff started taking over.
Legitimate options. You could actually go to the game store and there was other people playing other games, and you could be like, oh, like, I can show up here and not have to play this unfun game that's become like really intolerant and sort of weird. You know, I do remember talking about that.
Yeah. And so now here we are, the basically the byproduct of that conversation in some corporate office where they're saying, hey, we got to do something to be number one again, or we're going to lose it all. You know, we've built this 20 years of gaming culture, 30 years of gaming culture around what really is great fluff and an awesome community and great group of tabletop gamers are some of the most like welcoming type of gamers that I've ever been around a majority of the time. And you know, without embracing that, you're just sort of, you're going to slowly die, wither and die on the vine, you know? And so now, hopefully, them reaching out, them doing all these things, we're heading in a good direction. Yeah.
Looking forward to it. And it's looking like no one's actually come out and said it, but that mid-June, that second week of June, sure looks like the optimal time for this thing to drop.
Yeah. I mean, right now it's hard for me to believe any of the rumors and rumor sources that come out just because GW is freely and openly doing their own rumors now. I mean, they're with this, mm-hmm. with this daily drip of information. But all of the rumors are indicating, you know, June 10th, June 17th, somewhere in there. Yeah. And it kind of goes back to what we've all been saying for about a year now. And it looks like this summer, you know, is definitely going to be the time where we're going to see it. But one thing that was snuck into a recent document with the Primark Marines is they did say that by the end of May they will tell us when the release date is. So that's even more of a gut feeling that it's going to be in June. But I guess a couple weeks more of speculation and we're going to find out, which is just very exciting.
Yeah. What do you think? Do you think it's going to be like super easy to get, or you think you're going to be showing up to the game shop on that Saturday morning and like, oh, we only got 3 copies?
That's absolutely a concern, and honestly, it's been one that people have kind of shouted at them on their Twitch stream, and people on Twitter have sort of asked them. I myself have tweeted them like,
That's the kind of product you want that day.
Exactly.
You don't want it the next day. You don't want it 2 days later. You want it that day.
Right. And unfortunately for me, it looks like I'm not going to be in the country or around an area where I can get it that day. So unfortunately, I'm going to have to wait. But for the rest of you who can get it that day, I'm hoping they don't short ship. I'm hoping, you know, it's all out there. But who knows? To be completely honest, even if I am abroad and I can't purchase the book, I'll find a way to buy the online copy, you know, and have it so I can read it.
Yeah, you totally could buy the e-version right off the website.
Exactly. So, I mean, I guess in that respect, it's going to be available. And, you know, it's realistic to believe that we're going to get all the data slates for every unit for free or very inexpensively. We're going to get the basic rules for free. We're going to have to pay for the General's Handbook equivalent. We're going to have to pay for the point values and whatever else, you know, is hidden in that magical book where they detail out match play, probably the missions and things like that. So my hope and my guess based on where Age of Sigmar is we're going to be looking to spend maybe $40 to $50 on, you know, day one.
basic rule book.
Yeah, rather than maybe, you know, what was the current one? The three-book cardboard thing was like $90 or $100.
Yeah, that was a good – that was a chunk of change.
You know, so I think we're going to see it. I just hope, like you said, that they keep up with the volume. I mean, I every new release that I've wanted to get my hands on, I've not been able to get that day. And that's,
yeah, that's difficult.
That's just – that's the nature of it, I guess, but it's unfortunate.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I don't know, some lively 40K talk. I don't know, do we want to round it up, or do we want to are there any other hot 40K items we want to discuss here?
Not really. I mean, I was thinking about it in prepping for the show, waiting for you to call, and the only thing I was really thinking about is, like, I'm really really happy the way they've been releasing and previewing and talking. In fact, for me, it's a little much. Every day.
One or two articles every day in the last week or so.
Quite keep up anymore, which is
I've been trying to like link them not only on the veterans site but also on our personal groups, and I know I must have missed some, but it's been like I think two articles a day this past week, and in the last week or so before that was one article a day.
That's not a complaint or anything. It's just
not at all.
It's just sort of like it's more than I would have needed to keep me excited about
upcoming release. But I think it's even more of an indication that it must be coming soon, because you can't keep this current rate of information flow without basically giving it all away eventually.
You know? I heard that there's some one of those wacky groups. Some people actually like collected all of the rules that were released and mm-hmm. attempted to play a game.
I think I saw that on YouTube. I haven't watched it yet. But
I didn't watch it. I just heard people saw people writing about it. I think they used like the stats for the Rubric Marines versus the stats for Space Marines, and they had, you know, it was just kind of funny. But that's how rabid people are about about it.
Yeah, it's going to be a different beast. It's going to be a different animal. I mean, they've a lot of the things that people complain about in this game, and I'm just going to mention a couple things as I round this out, but like, you know, infinite summoned units. You know, mm-hmm. they've already come out and said, no, you're going to pay points for these things. Like, they've already... Problem addressed. You know what I mean? Death Stars and nigh unkillable characters soaking up all the wounds for the dudes behind them. Nope, we're going to fix that. Now, is it going to be perfect? Who knows? But they're at least aware of it, and they're focusing on it.
Try to tone it down. They're not going to tone. They're going to miss some things, and the power gamers are going to find it. But hopefully, it'll become more of a Kings of War like situation, where even if you are cheesing the rules as much as possible, someone else who's not doing that can still match up with you and have a game.
Yeah.
Not just totally not be able to interact with. It's all about the interaction. You get to do some cool stuff. Get to kill a few of your enemy's units, even though you may never have really been poised to win the game at any point. You pushed your models around. You BS'd and rolled dice and blew stuff up. So
yeah,
like
had fun.
It's not, and yeah, exactly.
You know,
that would be the ideal. Sort of new look of 40K that you can't just tilt every game with some kind of thing that, oh, I didn't really know that was a possibility, I wasn't prepared for that, and now I'm just sort of picking up my models and that just stops being fun real fast. If they cannot do that, we're golden, you know?
Right. I mean, they're in a great position, and if the game is easily teachable, you know, easy to learn, hard to master, then it's going to do nothing but to make them more successful.
Make it so balanced that people are constantly making lists, and like there is no like uber build. You're always like, maybe this is a little bit better, maybe that's a little bit better, and then you're still appeasing the power gamer. You can still tweak and try and like squeeze the cheese. But you can't create the unfun play experience.
Right, and it's going to encourage people, players that are more similar to like yourself, Bob, that enjoy playing the game, but don't necessarily enjoy going to an event at a store when you're supposed to play three games, you're maybe going to enjoy one game. You know, it's going to be a lot more incentive to be like, hey, why don't you come play three games? They're going to be about 90 minutes apiece, and no matter what, you're going to have fun, and you're probably going to win a couple of them. You know, that's a whole different atmosphere.
As long as the tournament people kind of, you know, my concern would be that tournaments would say, oh, now we've got this faster streamlined game, let's do a five game tournament, which again that would turn me off again.
Exactly.
If people went tournaments and competitive events or day long events went the tack of you're gonna play 3 90 minute games, I would be much, much more interested in going to like whatever, because they wouldn't be day long events anymore. They'd be like half day events. Right. And I can do that.
Yeah, I agree. So yeah, I mean, just rounding off our 40K talk, like I said, it's just a lot of good things heading our way. Let's hope it continues moving, and realistically, by the next time we're available to podcast again, we may be in an 8th edition world. So, you know, play out the rest of 7th. If you're enjoying it, play the hell out of it. Enjoy it. Have fun with it. There's nothing wrong with that. Look forward to 8th edition. You know, try and have that childlike wonder as you wait and hope that not only have they, you know, identified the problem areas of their game, that they've actually, you know, worked to address it. And let's all, you know, start 8th edition with a positive spin on things, and let's keep keep a realistic point of view, but let's not look at everything in an isolated vacuum, and look at the whole piece, the whole system, and how it all works together, and hopefully we'll find some enjoyment and balance in that. And I'm really looking forward to see what the missions look like and secondary objectives and things like that. So, lots of cool 40K stuff on the way. So we're moving on to our main feature, and you guys are going to have to listen to me chit-chat a little bit longer.
I don't have a lot to contribute to this. You're going to talk Dark Age.
Yeah, I just want to discuss Dark Age. A lot of cool things going on. Just sort of this next, just to pan back for about a few minutes, these next 4 to 6 weeks for me are some big weeks. I have a travel vacation next week. Like I said, a trip abroad in a couple weeks. I have to officiate a wedding in between those two trips. And also there's 8th edition 40K coming out, right? How much more action-packed could my early summer get? Well, let's layer on a brand new core rulebook for my second favorite game right now, Dark Age. Brand new rulebook just came out last week or the week before. They had their Immortals Championship, which is sort of their grand championship of their tournament year. And they released a new core rulebook, which is more or less like a polishing up of their previous rule system, a lot of cleaning up of wording, a few key rules changes, which I won't get into a lot of the crunch. I know we're not a strictly Dark Age podcast. It would probably bore a lot of our listeners, but just some real good cleaning and refining of the rules, some redeclaring of kind of what these special abilities or special defenses or attacks or whatever. Just restating how these things work, cleaning up a lot of the phases. There's also brand new missions introduced into the game, and they're very good at creating some interesting and creative missions. There's a brand new secondary objective system, where prior to this there was a secondary objective deck, which you dealt yourself up to two cards at the beginning of every turn, and there's always a primary objective to a mission and a secondary objective, and so the secondary objective would be to score whatever the mission is on your card. It could be kill the model with the highest point value. It could be go over to an objective and gain loot counters. It could be a number of different sort of objectives that you need to accomplish to get these secondary objectives completed. And prior to this edition, it was a deck of, I think, 30 or 34 cards. Well, with this new core rulebook, what they've done is they've given you a selection of 20 cards, and they flat out said in the rulebook that there will be expansions to this selection of cards. But what you need, what your ability to do is build a deck of 16 or more cards that are tuned into how your faction works. Now, some factions are inexpensive guys that run around and gather objectives. They gang up on bigger targets. Some factions are very few, very husky, pain-dealing close combat monsters, and everything kind of in between, including these sort of like magic casters called psychogenics and things like that. And so you can customize your secondary objective deck to be more personalized to your specific chosen group of soul, your war band or whatever you want to call it, which is really cool, because if you make a super killy group that's basically their job is to run to the middle of the table and table or destroy your opponent, you can put in all your secondary objective cards, which are kill this unit, assassinate that unit. You know, everything is a killing type of spin to it. If you're an objective-based faction and you have a lot of slaves or you have a lot of inexpensive troops like scuts and things like that that can get from objective to objective and claim this and hold board space and things like that, then you'd make your secondary objective deck so that your warband could exploit those kind of rules. So I think that's going to open up a whole new layer. It's sort of what people sort of hinted that Maelstrom deck was going to be for 40K. Back when that came out, and it never turned out to be that. Well, this is just that. It's a selection of cards, and you can customize your deck to your faction. That's super exciting for me as a player of Dark Age. I have sort of the list that I believe is a very good tournament list, but I've now collected a few new models and a different faction, and I'm very much looking forward to sort of using that faction to springboard myself into this new 2017 rulebook system. Also released within the last couple weeks, and they're slowly hitting their online web store, is a bunch of new models. They've created a new faction, the Earthcast of their alien faction called the Draugiri, and these are in the fluff. These are some lost characters who have returned to the fluff through various different reasons and ways. And basically, it's a way for them to splash in a few new models. They become sort of another sub-faction that can be used as an ally for a number of other factions. It's a great way to introduce some new models. They got new cards, so I've already been able to look at their rules, because once again, the core rules and all the stat cards and everything you need to play Dark Age is free online, except the models. You obviously got to buy those. But I've already looked at the rules for these new models. I've already started developing lists looking at them. And these new models exploit something else that they've done. They've done a lot of revitalizing in the last couple weeks. They used to release models in single packs, like blister packs, like old 40K, where you know you'd get one of this guy mm-hmm. or sometimes two of this guy in a $15 pack or so. Well, now they're releasing these unit boxes.
And yeah, so, they look like little Malifaux boxes.
Yeah,
kind of, right?
It's very much in that vein. Yeah, exactly. And you'll get maybe
I like that format, the crew style. Like you get four or five in a box.
Right, because there's a lot of circumstances where you'll have. Like Firestorms is an example. They're a model that have flamethrowers. Well, there's like a Firestorm leader character that if you mm-hmm. have that one, it makes them all better together as a group, and it just makes sense to buy them as a unit.
Right.
So very cool. I like that direction. I do wish that somehow you could still purchase a single model out of the because.
Yeah, that's the same thing in Malifaux.
If you own like three of them, you got to buy the box of five.
Yeah, you get one crew box, but then you need one model out of this crew box, so you got to buy the whole thing to get the one model. So it creates that trap of you end up having to buy more than you really want, blah, blah, blah. But, hey, you know, we're gamers. We spend money on the hobby.
Right, and honestly, these are not super expensive purchases. You're talking a unit box for anywhere from like $40 to $60, which in the world of tabletop gaming is not a huge purchase, you know. So very exciting stuff. Like I said, just kind of trying to go over my list. They have their tournament. Like I said, it reached their apex. It's apex this past couple weeks, and the faction that won is the Aircast. And so what they're developing now is their next year's what they call March to Immortality (MTI). That's their tournament circuit. And so within the next week or so, they're going to be releasing their 2017 tournament packet. And so if you want to run an official Dark Age tournament, these are the rules, restrictions, missions, you know, list building restrictions, everything you need, including, you know, the time allowed in rounds based on the number of players in your tournament. Basically, all the framework for everything you'd want to do in from a tournament perspective for Dark Age is in this MTI document, and that should be out in the next couple weeks. So, you know, just very exciting time right now in the world of Dark Age. They're pumping out some fantastic new models. They recently had some warehousing shipping issues, but they've moved to a new facility. You know, hopefully their orders pick up speed and things like that. There have been a few issues. I'm going to be, you know, completely transparent with how much I love Dark Age, but also some aggravations. I'm not the only one who's experienced this. There's a number of players out there. There's a very active Facebook group, and we keep in touch. But you order the model, you wait an extra long period of time because of the warehousing issues. You finally get the blister in, you open it up, and there's pieces missing, or they've packed the wrong model, or there's been a number of kind of pick-pack type of issues. And they do resolve them, and they're very good about them. And honestly, again, in the thought of transparency, I've had a couple of issues, and I ordered the new left arm for one of my models. They not only sent me a left arm, they sent me a completely new model for that faction, just a different type of model as a sort of, I'm sorry you had this issue. So they're aware of it. They're trying their best to keep their sort of their customer base happy by giving them sort of free stuff and saying we're sorry. But I'd rather have things shipped quickly and correctly than continue getting free stuff late and have this whole, you know, you order something.
Where is the company out of?
They're out of Marietta, Georgia, Atlanta, Georgia, somewhere in that area. So, you know, it's all domestic. I'm not sure what all the issues are, and they've been trying to be real transparent. Again, on the Facebook, they have a number of employees that are on there a lot, and they're, you know, apologizing and trying to do their best to keep everybody happy. But it's got to be tough on them, too, because they're the ones sort of on the front line. They got to take the guff on Facebook, you know. But regardless, hopefully they get over this issue. I guess this has been a classic sort of cool mini or not issue for a long time. Well, hopefully it's resolved. Hopefully we're going to be able to move forward. A lot of exciting stuff, and it would really be a lot easier for someone like me or like Dan at Off the Wall to get new players into this game if it's easy for them to get models. You know, we just talked about, we're tabletop wargamers. We don't mind spending money on models. You can't buy what you can't, you know, get from the company. Right. So it makes it very difficult.
It's been a theme tonight talking about we want to buy something, but we can't get our hands on it. Don't do that to us. That makes gamers very annoyed.
Yeah, and honestly,
don't not let us spend our money on you.
And as silly as it sounds, a lot of gamers start to form that hardness, you know, and that's why a lot of people are so sour on GW right now, is just sort of that, like, you ignored me too long and now I'm mad at you. And and people get that way with their, you know, I'm not ordering from Cool Mini or Not again because they can't ship quick enough. And it's sort of like, well, if you don't order from them, they're not going to exist anymore. So you won't have anything to order, you know, so it's chicken egg kind of thing, you know, but hopefully it all gets better. I understand that the last probably 4 or 5 years have been a big boom, and a lot of these other companies that focus on a lot of Kickstarters kind of get caught in this loop where it's hard for them to catch up, but you got to adapt and comply or you're going to get left behind. So hopefully they're able to do that. But anyway, yeah, just a quick talk about Dark Age. Just wanted to kind of, you know, spit some of the new stuff, get it out in front of people. I posted a few links on the Facebook over the last week or so. It's a super fun game. The models are getting better and better, and they're going through their older factions and rebalancing them, and their two oldest factions now are due for an update, and they've promised that they're coming in the upcoming months. So it's sort of that feeling in 40K when there's only a codex or two left in the cycle. You know, it's like we'll all feel whole again once these two factions are updated. And I think it's just the game's heading in a good direction. If anyone wants to give it a whirl, I certainly encourage it. Download the rules, check it out. Super easy to learn, lots of fun. And I think it's definitely one of those games, like we talked about with Shadow War Armageddon a couple weeks ago when we tried to play, where, you know, even the rule book in Dark Age now says you should have 50% of your board covered with terrain. And they've added new definitions to their terrain to include levels and climbability and things like that.
Yeah,
they definitely want to transition the game into sort of that multi-level terrain Shadow War Armageddon type, you know. And I think that does nothing but make these skirmish level games that much more exciting and that much more interesting. So
yeah, that first night when people were first playing Shadow War, I felt like the terrain was more set up for like kill team style games. And then when I came back this last night, you guys had much more like ladders and like planks and gantries and walkways. So it seems like you're going in that direction too. That first game I had, it was just a really weird terrain setup and a really matchup. But
that wasn't the best first day of
when you
Shadow
play
War.
with. I think it's much more about you know, the multi-level and...
Right. The game just gets way more interesting and way more sort of intricate. You can go places with the simple, you know, rules that are laid out before you once you start getting in those more complex scenarios and stuff. And honestly, one of the things that we noticed in Shadow War, and it's true in Dark Age as well, concerning the terrain, is you have some factions that have special rules that say, we'll use Shadow War as an example, you need ladders to climb up levels. Well, we were just saying, well, let's just pretend there's ladders everywhere. Well, there's two specific factions in the game, the Harlequins and the Tyranids, that have special rules that allow them to ignore ladders and climb up anywhere.
So the side of a
building. Right. So we're immediately hindering those factions because we're not playing the game the way it's intended. So that was sort of our
motivation. Well, I don't think either one of those factions needs to be. Those seems like everyone's complaining about those two as the most broken.
It's true so far. But it, you know. Anyway, you know, just a lot of cool stuff for Dark Age. Check them out.
So you're playing Dark Age now with dense multi-level terrain?
I haven't had an opportunity to play since the rulebook comes out, but that's my intention next time we play.
You guys never used to do that. You used to play kind of terrain light, right?
Yeah, and honestly, even the pictures from their tournament over the past couple of weeks has been what I would call terrain light. There certainly haven't been a lot of levels and stuff. So I think they have a deal going with Warsenal. Warson.al, or however you pronounce it. It's an MDF terrain.
Oh, you think so? They're
going to
come up with some.
They've
dark
come out with
terrain.
Some new terrain. They have. They've released three or four pieces of Dark Age specific terrain, and they also make a bunch of, you know, MDF counters and plastic counters and stuff for Dark Age. So I think that's definitely the direction they're heading. They're not quite there yet. Now with the terrain that we have in the sector, I think you're going to. I'm going to start pushing for more Dark Age games with a more intricate levels and things of that nature, just because it makes the game that much more interesting. It makes it that much more fun. And for those factions that have the rules that allow you to do, you know, climb whatever, do whatever, it's important to have that. There's a thing called a drill worm for one of the factions. It's literally a worm with a drill on its head, and they burrow underground and they can get, you know, higher toughness but can't attack and things like that. But their hindrance is they can't climb levels. Well, if you don't have levels, you've now taken their hindrance away, so they're theoretically more powerful than they should be. You know, so it's just one of those things where when you start playing a game and you start introducing yourself to a game, it's important to think about the real interaction that terrain has with the table and sort of the environment it's meant to be played in. And you had a great point with Shadow War. We did need a lot more terrain, and that was one of the first things Luke and I kind of focused on, is like, let's really see, you know, what we can do and how we can improve this in the short term, and then kind of make a plan to make some more pretty terrain, months or a year from now, and kind of get it, you know, better looking as we go, get it functional now kind of thing. Important points to call out, and I think those are good things to talk about.
Yeah, we need to do a terrain day or something.
I definitely agree. Hopefully sometime this summer, we'll try and get something together. The last one kind of got snowed out, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely a terrain day would be very, very good. So, yeah, that's all. I'm all set with Dark Age now. We can move on.
Dark Age down. Yeah, I don't have, like I said, I don't have a lot to contribute because I don't play the game. My wallet thanks me for the one game that I don't play, so. You want to do a little something shiny?
Yeah, I guess we can do a little something shiny, and then we can call it a
night.
Okay.
All right, let's talk about this because we've talked about it off the show a couple of times, and I mentioned it at the beginning of the show. These new, they're like unpainted, they're sort of pre-primed miniatures for both. They both have the D&D logo, some of them, and some of them have the Pathfinder logo. And they're both really nice quality gray, primer gray minis. I haven't tried. I don't know if there's specifically you're supposed to not prime them. I have primed them, and they come out fine.
So you reprime the pre-prime miniatures?
Just because I wanted. Well,
I'm just teasing.
I don't know. I don't know if technically. I don't know if they're officially called pre-prime miniature, but they are that primer gray plastic.
Or they maybe do, they do advertise them as like ready to paint, so I don't know.
Oh, okay, so maybe I don't need to prime them. I don't really prime models. I just sort of paint them black.
Yeah, me too.
So, I picked up. Like I was talking about my Kings of War army earlier. The Hellhounds. They make both character models, you know, like rangers and wizards and stuff like that. But they also make monsters. They have a nice range of all kinds of monsters. I purchased some zombies and some ghouls. They have a nice looking displacer beast. So all the D&D nice. Not all, many of the D&D monsters are represented. The Hellhounds that I mentioned that I use in my Kings of War army are one of a few that are actually clear plastic, which is interesting because I don't really know how to approach those as a model. Like, I believe you're supposed to like paint portions of them and leave portions of it clear, but I don't know if I have the you know, like what I don't know how I would get the paint off if I got it in the wrong spot, you know. So I don't really know.
Yeah. Now back to Dark Age for a second. They make there's elementals for my faction, and they make a like a metal version, and mm-hmm. then they make a, it's like a transparent bluish plastic color. Yeah, and the guys online kind of like there's the best looking ones to me are sort of the fire elementals, and then they kind of dry brush black on it, so it looks like, mm-hmm. you know, orange and red is mm-hmm. sort of emanating from this black cracking skin. But I don't know what I would do with like a dog type thing that's clear, you know what I mean? It's not going to be like glowing a color. I'd probably end up just priming and painting it, but that wouldn't really be kind of taking advantage of the
clear. I haven't touched them yet. I have done the ghouls. They came out nice. They're on the Facebook page, and I'm working on the zombies right now. But yeah, it's kind of interesting that they're like the D&D ones have the D&D logo on it. They have the Wiz Kids logo and the Wizards of the Coast logo.
Wow.
And the Pathfinders ones have the Paizo logo on it. I don't know what else, but I've always seen them sold together. So it's not like they're in competition with one another. They're sort of like co-lines, but I guess it's more about the, whatever the licensing or the IP.
Right.
But both, lines are, you know, same quality, same look. The models look great. I mean, the Pathfinder has a little more of a stylized, you know, their characters do.
Yeah,
you know,
almost like anime-esque kind of.
That Pathfinder look, which not my particular cup of tea, but none of them are particularly over the top. And I'm enjoying them. They're cheap. They're, you know, they're for like $4.50 for usually you get two in a box, and they're good quality. They don't like they're not bent or warped or anything. They're like really good solid plastic. So I would highly recommend those if anyone is. I guess one thing I didn't really get to mention earlier was like it's just interesting being. A miniature wargamer painter, but not one that has lately focused on GW models. Mm-hmm. Like, explore. I would encourage other people to explore the other side. Like, check out other companies. Check out the Bones miniatures. Check out the Metal Reapers or these new D&D and Pathfinder minis, because it's just a different vibe. Like picking up two or four zombie models, they're pre-assembled. You're not clipping them off the sprue, you're not gluing them together, you're just gluing them to a base and painting them. It's just like a different hobby experience. It's like a little, you know, you can drop off at the, you know, like what I did with the ghouls. Like I hit the comic shop on Friday on my way home from work, and Sunday morning I was like feeling like painting, and I just had a little, you know, little 2-3 hour project, painted these four models, boom, boom, boom. It's just different than like cracking a box of 10 Space Marines and gluing them all together. I mean, right, which is fun. I enjoy that. I enjoy the bigger projects. I enjoy, you know, putting together a Land Raider or this or that, but it's just a different vibe when you're checking out other companies and just doing miniature wargaming a little differently and checking out different models. And
I think for me, when I started getting, like, especially a lot of those bone stuff for my Kings of War army is even the Wrath of Kings stuff, I start to really get a deeper appreciation of the quality of sculpting and ability that GW has over some of these other companies. And that's not a knock on these other companies. They have their own niche, and GW's carved out their own, but...
Well, to the credit of these D&D ones, the spider minis that I showed you, those quality, like the Reaper bones, the big spiders and dryads and stuff, they're okay, but the D&D ones had really nice detail on. There's several different spider miniatures, a couple different sizes. I don't know if any of them have a dark elf on the back or anything, like a dryad or a rider, but you should check those out. Those
I definitely will.
Really nice models. I don't know. I'm sorry I interrupted you. I think you were in the middle of saying something.
I don't know. I'm not even sure where I was going with it, but I guess I was just kind of mentioning that, like, don't feel like you're, you know, betraying GW if you start painting these other models or whatever. You're going to get a deeper appreciation, actually. You know, when I painted up, like, I painted the Hellhounds that I use as my Chimera and my Eldar Force. Excuse me. I painted those up, and they went so quick. They're just dogs with some fur and some bones sticking out of them, you know? And the models were those bones figures, single model. I basically opened up the blister, glued it onto a poker chip, and spray painted it black, and boom, I was ready to start painting, you know? And by the time I was done, they looked great. Then I went on to my Warp Spiders, which are very old Games Workshop models. We're talking 20-plus years old. And just the intricacy of detail that was on their bodies it was just differently detailed than the Bones models were, and it's not a knock on the Bones ones.
They can be
just
a little,
just
what they are. That's what that plastic does.
It's exactly. So it's very cool. It gives you a deeper appreciation as a painter and as a modeler and as a collector, because you start to see sort of what other companies' fortes are. You know, especially when you're dealing with D&D and Pathfinder models, where like you might want like a human, but you don't want the human to look like maybe a GW human with inflated fists and heads, and you know, you want something maybe more scaled or a little into this historical line, and maybe they don't have as much detail in the faces and hands, but the armor's really intricate. Just every little company has its own little niche, and you get a deeper appreciation, like you said, once you start exploring those other lines.
Totally. So that would be my main something shiny, those D&D and Pathfinder minis. Check them out if you have not yet. They're fairly new. In addition, just a couple other quick shout-outs. Finally got to track down a pretty hard-to-find comic. Always a big comic fan and looking for the next sort of hotness. I don't know if this is necessarily going to be hotness, but this is a comic that it's called Animosity, and it's sort of in that post-apocalyptic, sort of very big story arc a la Why the Last Man or Preacher, or like the kind of story that you can tell the storyteller has. It's not just a bunch of random comic book stories strung together. It's an overarching story with a beginning, middle, and end. And I don't have the comic in front of me and can't shout out the writer or artist, but both quality writing and quality art. And this Animosity takes the sort of post-apocalyptic vibe a little bit in a different light. It's not, it's basically all animals have become sentient and intelligent, and they basically revolt and turn on humanity. And cool. I've only been able to pick up one issue, but it's basically there's this sentient dog, sort of like a not a Saint Bernard, but like a you know, husky kind of hound of a dog that's intelligent, and he is trying to assist this little girl who is, again, just through one episode, she's in some kind of peril, and there's these other animals that are assisting, and they're all, the animals are kind of trying to figure out their sentience and how this happened, and like, based on the lifespan of the animal, like, they acquire their intelligence, like, you know, some of them, if they have a short lifespan, they like get their intelligence like in one big burst. And it's just kind of interesting the way the story is being told. I've only been able to pick up like number five, so it's kind of hard to quite track, you know, get a sense of the whole story, but I am desperately trying to pick the book up and seek it out if you like good, you know, really well-developed comic book tales that are well-drawn. Also, I recommend Animosity.
Nice.
And that's about it for me. I will shout out, I did a book review of, Playing at the World, that if you remember from a month or two ago, that massive tome about the history of wargaming and chess all the way up to D&D. I did that book review. Check it out if you didn't get to hear it and you're interested in this kind of thing. I'm very interested in history of gaming. But I will shout the book out again because I am nearing the end of its like massive 700 pages.
Oh, that's awesome.
But it's really good. It's check out the review. I'm not going to re-review the book, but I did find a little interesting gem. This book is so well referenced and it's researched down to the level of you know, a lot of the fanzines that were being written and mimeographed and Xeroxed in the 50s and in the 60s and in the 70s. And it's just really, really insightful in what wargamers were like, you know, way, way back when. It's surprisingly, well, not surprisingly, maybe, but America was kind of the place for wargaming in like the 60s and stuff, with that when Avalon Hill was
okay.
putting out, you know, that was like the hotness for like games. You know, people were doing it in other places also, but where prior to World War II, a lot of wargaming was happening in Europe, in mm-hmm. Austria and places like that. But nonetheless, I found this really interesting because you and I have this conversation a lot, and this podcast has this conversation a lot, the whole sort of the balance and the frustration sometimes between, you know, power gamers or you know, high level competitive type players and people that want to play the game a little more casually. And mm-hmm. it's just really interesting that this book was able to show that same, very similar sort of conflict dates way back. I'm going to quote something. I think it's from a fanzine from like 1961 or 1962. I'll quote it. It's just a quick paragraph. There were two quite different attitudes involved. That of the realist and that of, for want of a better word, the gamesman. The realist's rules are designed to create a game as close to the real thing as circumstances and model soldiers will allow, while the latter chooses rules which permit a player to win a game, not by tactical skill, but by simply manipulating the rules to give an unfair advantage. And that's from like Wargamer's Digest from wow. 1961 or 1962. It's just so interesting to think that at the dawn of some, you know, wargaming was so in its infancy, and it was just like being played on college campuses, and you know, Americans were just sort of delving into this, and you already saw some people who wanted to devour rules and like sort of how can we manipulate and sort of play with this, and other people wanted the, you know, they wanted a simulation.
The reenactment experience.
And it's really interesting that dates so far back in our hobby.
Yeah, it's basically, I mean, like you said, it's the same conversation we have now. It's the same, what's the solution that GW is coming up with 8th is just the same as they did with Age of Sigmar. There's three ways to play. I mean, it's just different ways of addressing that exact core issue. And that's it really puts some perspective on the conversation. It doesn't feel like it's this, you know, competitive players are breaking the game. Well, that's, I mean, I guess that's been the issue from the beginning, you know? So it's,
well, the issue is that competitive play trumps all. You can't have competitive right. play and something else. It's exactly. competitive play. You know, it's either it is or it isn't. So
right, right.
that sort of becomes the issue is, like, sometimes people want not that, and they can't always find it.
Right.
Right.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely.
So that kind of circles us back around to some conversations that we were having way at the beginning of the show. So I don't know, maybe we should make this an exodus.
All right. Sounds good. It's been good chatting with you, Bob. And
yeah.
We'll probably be take care of things probably the end of June. We'll probably get back together to try and get another episode in. And hopefully that week I'm back between trips, you and I get to hang out, maybe get another game of Kings of War in.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. You're going to be around on the 27th?
Yep. We're trying to get another gaming day going, so.
Yeah. Okay.
Cool.
All right.
All right, guys. All right. Thanks for listening. You know, iTunes, rate, review, Facebook, all that good stuff like we always say. And other than that, have a great night, and thanks for listening.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.